Today is Monday, April 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up, one of Ukraine's most popular TV actors appears on course to win the first round of a presidential race that's proving anything but ordinary.
And the opposition really is one of the most successful days they've had in decades. And for President Erdogan, it's been a major defeat.
That was Dorian Jones in Istanbul reporting on elections in Turkey. Also ahead, Britain is running out of time to reach a deal for exiting the European Union. And Japanese Emperor Akihito abdicates at the end of this month, and that will usher in a new era for the country. It's all on today's International Edition. One of Ukraine's most popular actors, who stars in a TV series about a schoolteacher who becomes president, appears likely to win the first round of the country's presidential race. Volodymyr Zelensky captured more than 30% of the vote yesterday, upending Ukraine politics. President Petro Poroshenko, the incumbent, with 16 to 19% of the vote, will give him a slot to run against Zelensky in the second round on April 21st. Zelensky won votes by promising to fight corruption and to challenge a political structure dominated by oligarchs. But his critics say he will not be strong enough to stand up to Russian President Vladimir Putin, who engineered Russia's takeover of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. Putin also has backed a separatist conflict in eastern Ukraine that has killed more than 10,000 people. Tatiana Voroshky is with VOA's Ukrainian service and has been covering the election. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson a short time ago about the election and what comes next.
So the results are in. We know that we know almost the latest results for the counting, and the foreign observers say that the vote appears to be smooth, so it's unlikely that the election results will be contested. So we're preparing, Ukraine is preparing for a runoff. The result is being for Volodymyr Zelensky has been expected, but still strong, maybe a little bit stronger than expected. He's 41 years old, he's a comedian, and he's the most known in the West as a person who played a president on TV. So he played in a TV show called Serving on the People. He's like an ordinary citizen, a teacher, and he became a president. In Ukraine, he's actually better known for it's a comedy club or improv show, District 95. They started in humoristic competition, he and his friends from his native city, and then they turned it into a big entertainment franchise, or not franchise, like a big entertainment business, which including producing movies, shows, touring with their comedy, and so forth. It's interesting that during the election campaign, he barely gave any interviews to the TV reporters, and those he did give were kind of unsuccessful, I would say, if they were not very good. But he toured with his show. So basically, voters paid money to see the candidate, which is, I think, Ukrainian know-how. He did not participate in debates, and he didn't go, like, if he wanted to go live, so there wasn't much. So we didn't, during the election campaign, people didn't have enough information of what are his views are and what is his team. We don't know, Ukrainians don't know his team yet, so he said yesterday that he will represent five people on his team by the runoff. And what we see in the most criticism, both in the West and in Ukraine, is focused on his lack of experience. What views he managed to express are mostly pro-Western, pro-European, but there is no apparent deep thinking which would tell us what his foreign policy is going to be. And President Poroshenko team will try to point to those factors, that he doesn't have enough experience to run the country during the aggression from Russia.
Well, let me ask a little bit about Mr. Poroshenko.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, he was they call him the candy oligarch, right? He made his fortune with a confectionery company.
Right.
And he's been in office now for several years. He has been dealing with the Russian incursion into the East and in Crimea. So tell us a little bit more about him and his politics.
Okay, Petro Poroshenko was elected as the president in May 2014, and that was the height of Russian aggression against Ukraine. And even before that, except for his business, he has pretty long political career. He was the Minister of Economy, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and the head of National Security Council in Yushchenko's government. And he's very well known in the West as a diplomat, not just as a president. His supporters, he himself, Western observers, point to many achievements of his presidency. Russian aggression turned from hot to the slowly burning conflict that leaves most people unaffected. Economy was slowly growing, despite that Ukraine has to spend more than most countries on its military. And also people got the opportunity to travel to the EU countries without visa. Ukrainian Orthodox Church got its independence from Moscow. A few successful reforms, including decentralization. So that's kind of his main point, and they will try to. That's what he built his campaign on, trying to present those achievements. The most criticism and why people did vote for Zelensky or for some other candidates, they all center around corruption, including his inner circle. And also on the fact that lives of most people did not improve noticeably during his presidency, and many Ukrainians left to work abroad.
That was my colleague Tatiana Voryshko in VOA's Ukrainian service speaking with Kate Pound-Dawson. Among the top stories trending in the world, Algeria's president Abdelaziz Bouteflika says he will resign by April 28th after weeks of public protests demanding a change in government. A Vietnamese woman is now the only person remaining in detention in Malaysia for killing the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. 20 people were killed when a double-decker bus burst into flames in Lima, Peru, and Australia plans tough social media laws targeting online hate. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, or AKP, suffered significant losses in local elections yesterday, including loss of control of the capital Ankara. In vote counting today, it appears his party also lost Istanbul, the financial and cultural center of the country. Journalist Dorian Jones is in Istanbul and covers Turkish politics. He says the losses in the major cities and several provisional cities are sending shockwaves through the country's political structure. He spoke a short time ago with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson.
Well, it does appear to be a very bad night for President Erdogan's AKP party. They have suffered major defeats across the country, losing key cities, notably the capital, Ankara. The first time in 25 years the opposition have seized control of the capital. And Istanbul, Turkey's most important city, by far the largest, the cultural, the industrial and financial center, and in many ways the political center of the country. Now that appears to have also fallen to the opposition as well. And a number of very other important provincial cities all across the country have fallen. And the opposition really is one of the most successful days they've had in decades. And for President Erdogan, it's been a major defeat.
Now, I understand there is some dispute still over the results. What is the basis of that?
Well, absolutely. The contests, several contests are in dispute now, given the fact there are very small margins of victory for the opposition parties. In particular, all attention really is focusing on Istanbul, where at the present moment, the challenger from the center-left CHP party, Ekrem İmamoğlu, appears to be won by around 25,000 votes. Now, that is out of a number of votes cast of 9 million, a wafer-thin margin of victory. The AKP, Binali Yildirim's candidate, is challenging that. He says that there are several hundred thousand invalidated votes, which should could tip the result in his favour. So at the moment, that is a centre of contention, and it really is because Istanbul is so important to Turkish politics. It is an absolutely seismic shock to the country that the ruling AKP party has appeared, at least, to have lost Istanbul. Few people expected this to happen, and the repercussions are expected to be felt for many years to come if indeed the opposition do prevail.
Now, what does this law signify? What does this election signify for Turkish politics going forward?
Well, I think that up until now, President Erdogan has built a reputation of more than 15 years of electoral success. He was seen as almost invincible in the ballot boxes. And even though his name wasn't on the votes in these elections, he led the campaign. He was at the front of the campaign. He made it a referendum about his rule because he understands that the control of the key cities, in particular the capital and Istanbul, is crucial to Turkish politics. It's one of the few centers of power that the presidency now doesn't control. For the opposition now to have seized these cities, this provides them with a potential platform going forward to provide an alternative way of ruling, a challenge to what until now is seen as the unchallenged power of Erdogan. And let's remember, President Erdogan, his career started way back in 1994 when he was an obscure politician and he won Istanbul. From that point on, he used that as a springboard to go on to dominate Turkish politics. The opposition will be hoping that history will repeat itself.
That was Dorian Jones reporting from Istanbul. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Britain is running out of time to reach a deal for exiting the European Union. Today, British lawmakers will again vote a series of motions for Brexit. Parliament has three times rejected the divorce deal that Prime Minister Theresa May struck with the European Union. The Associated Press's Charles Dolodesma reports.
The indicative votes try to find the right elusive idea that can command a parliamentary majority. Two ideas, staying in the EU customs union and holding a second referendum, have emerged as the most likely ones to succeed. But British Prime Minister Theresa May has so far ruled out both these two. Within reports, she could try to bring her original Brexit agreement back for a fourth time later this week. Meanwhile, some in the business community want lawmakers to simply unite around a compromise Brexit deal, worrying that the country's political chaos is making Britain a laughingstock. Charles Zuladesma, London.
Mozambican and international health workers are racing to contain an outbreak of cholera in the cyclone-hit city of Beira and surrounding areas. More than 1,000 cases of the potentially deadly disease have been found since last week. At least one person has died from cholera, which is spread by contaminated water and food. Cyclone Idai came ashore 2 weeks ago and has killed more than 800 people in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe. Flooding left some towns all but inaccessible due to roads and bridges being washed away. That has slowed relief efforts. For instance, the town of Buzi has been cut off since the storm. It took aid agencies nearly a week to begin delivering supplies to Buzi, and most has come by helicopter. Most of the Mozambicans killed by the cyclone were in the Buzi district. When Japanese Emperor Akihito abdicates at the end of this month, it will usher in a new era for the country. VOA Steve Miller has more on the new era that will be ushered in when Crown Prince Naruhito ascends to the chrysanthemum throne on May 1st.
Japanese Emperor Akihito will abdicate the imperial throne on April 30th of this year. When he does so, it will be the second time in nearly a century that Japan has ushered in a new era. A day later, on May 1st, the Reiwa era begins. Japan is the only remaining country in the world that continues to use the era name system, which has its roots in China. Under Emperor Akihito, the current era, Heisei, which translates to peace prevails everywhere or achieving peace, has spanned 30 years, impacting the daily lives of those in Japan. As the current era nears its end, it's inspired those in the country to reflect on the past three decades and look forward to the future. The new era name was chosen by a panel from a number of names submitted by scholars. The Reiwa era follows the traditional naming guidelines. It consists of only two Japanese characters, or kanji, is easily read and written, and doesn't use common words. The paired characters roughly translate to decree, order or command, and harmony, peace, and serenity. Following Monday's announcement, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe explained that Reiwa means culture is created by and nurtured by people who beautifully care about each other. Abe added that, quote, "With this selection of the new era name, I renew my commitment to pioneer a new era that will be filled with hope," end quote. The word Reiwa comes from prose in the Manyoshu, a collection of nearly 4,500 ancient Japanese poems organized into 20 books dating back to the 8th century. When announcing the new era name, Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, said in his words, "We hope the era name will be widely accepted by the people and deeply rooted as part of their daily lives." The announcement, made on April 1st, was the 248th of its kind, marking one of the final hurdles for Crown Prince Naruhito before he ascends to the throne. Naruhito was born on February 23, 1960, and studied at Oxford University for 2 years after earning a history degree in Japan. Emperor Akihito began his reign January 8, 1989, the day following his father's death, Emperor Hirohito, who is known posthumously as Emperor Showa. Steve Miller, VOA News, Seoul.
This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
It is expected that one day in the future, people will touch down and walk on Mars. There are also those such as Elon Musk of SpaceX who are working on ways to build and maintain human colonies on the red planet. But there are a number of challenges that block the pathway for human exploration of our planetary neighbor. A group of experts recently met in London to discuss the social and psychological aspects of traveling to and living on Mars. According to the meeting's lead organizer, Federico Caprotti of the University of Exeter, the biggest hurdles to Mars settlement are not technical but psychological. Those attending the meeting discussed such issues as humans developing interplanetary jet lag, the lack of the ability to be able to communicate in real time with Earth, and, of course, the inevitable personality clashes between members of the colony. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is urging the government of Brunei to stop its revised penal code from entering into force on Wednesday. Bachelet says the application of the death penalty under the new law, which she calls cruel and inhumane, violates international human rights law. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
Brunei's tourist brochures describe the country as a haven of tranquility. That may once have been the case, as Brunei, a Muslim monarchy, has not executed anyone since 1957. But its recent decision to impose the death penalty, including death by stoning, is stirring international outrage. Under the revised penal code, people would be executed for offenses such as rape, adultery, homosexual relations, robbery, and insult to the Prophet Muhammad. UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warns the new code, if implemented, would mark a serious setback for human rights protections in Brunei. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA, "It is very easy to fall afoul of this law because it is so broad.
For example, it criminalizes exposing Muslim children to the beliefs and practices of any religion other than Islam. It also introduces public flogging as a punishment for abortion, for example, which again would disproportionately affect people who are already vulnerable. It would disproportionately affect women."
Shamdasani says there's no contradiction between human rights and faith. They are not opposing forces. She says her office has worked with religious leaders from all over the world to draft the so-called Beirut Declaration on Faith for Rights.
And this is a very constructive document, which again helps countries that, you know, are motivated by the desire to integrate religious tenets into their law to do so while fully respecting international human rights obligations, so that they can work jointly to uphold human dignity and equality for all.
International law allows for the imposition of the death penalty only for the crime of murder or international killing. Bachelet says any religion-based legislation must not violate human rights. She says her office is ready to work with the Brunei government to bring it into compliance with its international human rights obligations. Sultan Hassanai Bolkiah rules the oil-rich monarchy and is one of the world's wealthiest people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A groundbreaking new exhibit at the museum in Washington, D.C. marks the 50th anniversary of a police raid on a gay bar in New York's Greenwich Village and highlights key moments in the modern gay rights movement in America that many believe was born out of that historic event. For some members of the LGBTQ community, the exhibit is deeply personal. VOA's Julie Tabo has more.
The streets around the Stonewall Inn are quiet now. But 50 years ago, in June of 1969, this popular gay bar in New York City was the site of violent confrontation when an unprovoked police raid triggered widespread outrage. The uprising resulted in several days of riots and demonstrations, which many believe was the catalyst for the modern gay rights movement. Now, a new exhibit at the museum in Washington, D.C. explores that tumultuous period. Exhibit writer Christy Wolliver says it focuses on the courageous efforts of everyday Americans.
This big movement was spurred on by people who wanted to make a change, whether that's fighting for the right to work and serve, whether that's parading in the streets and celebrating who you are, or whether that's winning the right to marry.
Jim Obergefell was one of those people. He fought for marriage equality in the state of Ohio for him and his longtime partner, John Arthur, who had been diagnosed with a fatal disease.
Because we lived in Ohio where we were not able to get married, we chartered a medical jet and flew to Baltimore, where we parked on the tarmac at BWR Airport and got married inside that airplane. And then when we learned that the state of Ohio, at the time John died, would ignore our legal marriage and say that he was unmarried and not list my name as his surviving spouse, we decided we weren't willing to stand for that, and we filed suit against the state of Ohio. And that ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court, where we won. And on June 26, 2015, marriage equality became the law of the land.
Obergefell loaned personal objects to the museum to illustrate his story. The couple's wedding rings, the jacket he was wearing when they got married, and the bow tie he wore when the Supreme Court decision was announced. Other trailblazers are also represented in the museum. Frank Kameny, who many consider the father of the LGBTQ rights movement, used this portable typewriter to create memos, pamphlets, and protest materials. There's a display case for Harvey Milk, a leading human rights activist and one of the country's first openly gay elected officials assassinated after only a year in office. There's memorabilia from Congressman Barney Frank, who announced he was gay in 1987 after having served for three terms. And a red dress from Tammy Baldwin, who in 1998 became the first openly gay woman to be elected to the U.S. Congress. John Lake, who works for one of the sponsors of the exhibit, found it deeply personal.
Going through the exhibit, I see these moments that now impact my life in a very real way. Like seeing Jim Obergefell's jacket that he was married in, that happened around the same time that I proposed to my husband, and to see those moments really coming to life for the community, it just really brings it home.
While there have been great strides made in the gay rights movement over the past 50 years, many acknowledge that there's still much work to be done. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
You have been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Enjoy your day.